Hello and welcome to the Stumbled Upon podcast. I am your host, Kate, and each week we'll be taking a deep dive into a random topic that has sparked my interest. Before we get started, I hope that you're all having a wonderful Friday and are looking forward to the weekend ahead. This week's episode is regarding American fire safety, and I know, per usual, it's a pretty random topic, but here is where this topic sparked for me, no pun intended. I was watching the Grenfell Uncovered documentary on Netflix, and basically the story of the Grenfell Tower is that it was a fire that occurred and killed 72 people in 2017 when an apartment fire blazed out of control and consumed most of the building. If you have not seen this documentary or at least photos of this fire, I would encourage you to look it up because it is absolutely mind-boggling to see just the, it was a tower of flames, essentially like an inferno blazing. It's wild. One of the interesting aspects was that the residents who called emergency services were told to, quote, stay put, which is the standard UK fire policy for high-rise buildings. Basically, most buildings are supposed to be built so that if a fire starts in an apartment, it will stay contained for 60 minutes, approximately. Keeping residents inside their own apartments prevents them from entering smoky or dangerous hallways or stairwells and allows firefighters to put the fire out without having to deal with mass evacuations as well. As an American, the concept of not immediately evacuating in the event of a fire got me thinking about where our fire policies actually come from. As a side note, the Grenfell Tower tragedy is incredibly sad, not just for the massive loss of life and trauma suffered by survivors, but the fact that it was entirely preventable. I encourage you to watch the documentary if you have some time. And if not, it was a mix of corporate negligence and the fact that the fire brigade was not adequately prepared to deal with a fire of this magnitude or of this root cause. And so the advice that they gave people was not actually correct advice. They should have evacuated the building immediately. But again, they thought that they had time to put the fire out and that it would be safer for residents to stay inside their buildings or inside their apartments. Unfortunately, this caused a massive loss of life. Like I said, 72 victims, and the survivors themselves were incredibly traumatized, understandably, from this event. So, coming back to America, where did fire safety actually start? I looked this up, and back in 1631, the first fire safety laws and building codes were issued in Boston, Massachusetts, prohibiting the construction of wooden chimneys and thatched roofs in order to mitigate fire risks. Obviously, people knew at this time about building fires, and the fact that they were starting to settle into these cities meant that they needed to have some kind of awareness when it came to fire prevention. And really, it said that back in this time of our history, it wasn't so much on preventing fires. It was more reactionary than proactive at this time. So it was the regulations were more about how to put fires out rather than how to prevent them. And you really see the shift start in the 1800s. But before we get there, in 1736, the first volunteer fire department was created in Philadelphia, and then in 1872, we have the Great Boston Fire. This destroyed 776 buildings and killed at least 30 people downtown, and it caused the equivalent of $1.5 billion in damages. This led to new fire safety and building codes related to fire and life safety. So at this time, officials are starting to understand the importance of preventing fires or having these regulations in place to mitigate them as best they can, because these massive scale fires happen enough that they figure out that they need to do something to prevent them. Then in 1911, we have the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire. This is one of the deadliest industrial fires in the history of New York City. 146 workers died, and it was primarily because managers kept the exit doors locked to prevent workers from taking unauthorized breaks. This led to the creation of the Factory Investigating Committee with the purpose of reviewing industrial sites for fire safety and other health risks. It helped modernize labor laws and mandate better fire safety measures like building access mandates, fireproofing measures, and the installation of alarm systems and sprinkler systems. I remember learning about this, whether it be in social studies or history, I can't quite remember, but at this time in history, in the early 1900s, we as America were still trying to figure out the balance between industrialization and workers' rights, and a lot of people were working in really unsafe and unsanitary conditions, and this particular fire, because it was so deadly, it was such a massive scale, really put a focus on keeping buildings and factories in better safety conditions. So things like not locking your employees in was important for this time. I Googled why Grenfell Tower didn't have a central fire alarm or sprinkler system, because when I was reading about the shirtwaist factory fire and I saw that they had mandated alarm systems and sprinkler systems as a result of this for other factories and industrial warehouses, it got me thinking about the documentary and how there were none of those in the actual apartment tower itself, and I thought that was kind of strange. And so apparently there was no building-wide alarm because of the stay-put policy. They assumed that fires would be contained within individual apartments and full evacuation wouldn't be necessary. This is ironic considering the building managers knowingly used flammable cladding. So they're like, oh, we don't need to install alarms because it's not necessary. But then at the same time, they're installing improper materials. And so it's like, well, yeah, it's 100% necessary, but whatever. There was no sprinkler system because that wasn't a requirement for buildings built prior to 2007. And the tower itself was built in the 1970s. And the law didn't require that existing buildings be retrofitted with the sprinkler systems. In fact, the law still doesn't require that existing high-rises be retrofitted as of 2023, with no evidence that this has changed. So even to this day, apartment buildings or high-rise buildings built before 2007, as long as they have not requested permits for major renovations, then they are not required to retrofit the buildings with sprinkler systems, which is insane to me. What about fire drills? Well, the earliest fire drills originated in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, largely in response to deadly industrial fires. School fire drills are partially credited to Edward F. Crocker, the fire chief of the New York Fire Department from 1899 to 1911. He was considered a fire safety pioneer, and his advocacy led to widespread adoption of school fire drills, which emphasized the importance of teaching children how to respond quickly without panic in the event of a fire. As another side note, I have a lot of side notes for this episode. I don't remember fire drills being particularly scary when I was in school. However, for part of my schooling, I lived in Ohio and we had to do tornado drills in school, and those I remember being scary. And I remember them being scary because we would go into the hallways and you'd have to kneel down against with your head against the wall. So kind of in like the fetal position, knees on the ground, head against the wall, like tucked up in the corner. Then your hands would go behind your head, either on the back of your head or on your neck. And you just have to stay like crouched there for the tornado drill. And I remember thinking that there was no way that being in that position would save me if the building got ripped apart in a tornado. So that's what made those particularly scary, because I was like, what is the point of this? How is this going to save us? But I guess it's because the hallways are interior walls, and so they are structurally the most secure. But again, I don't really know how effective that would be in the event of an actual tornado running through the school. Hopefully that never occurs and we don't ever have to worry about it. But the other thing that I remember in school was jumping out of the back of the school bus for emergency drills. And I remember that being particularly scary when I'd have to go like jump out the back of the bus. So I think we had to just know that we could get out of the little roof hatches, because obviously they didn't dismantle the roof for us to jump out of it. But I remember they would show us how those could get kicked out, basically. And then we'd have to either evacuate, depending on where we were sitting on the bus, we'd have to either evacuate out of the front door or the back door. And I hated when I'd have to go out the back, because that jump from the back of the bus to the ground felt like it was 30 feet in the air. And so And I'm very afraid of heights. And so for me, that was just absolutely traumatizing, absolutely scary, like just so terrifying. And yeah, core memory right there, jumping out of the back of a school bus for emergency drills. Anyway, getting back to fire safety. In 1958, the fire at Our Lady of the Angels School in Chicago killed 92 students and 3 nuns, and it led to significant reforms in school fire safety, including more stringent fire drill requirements and better safety infrastructure in schools. The introduction of modern fire alarm systems, smoke detectors, and building codes in the 1960s and 70s helped shift drills from being reactionary measures to routine practice in schools and workplaces. This got me thinking too about firefighters visiting schools. Do you remember them visiting when you were younger? I remember when they would come and do demonstrations on how smoke detectors worked, and then they would turn them on so that we got familiar with what they sounded like, which is just so loud and irritating. And then I guess that's the point. And then what we should do in case we had a house fire, like we had to practice like low crawling. I remember at one point we had to practice touching a door with the back of our hands to see if it was hot or not. If the door was too hot, then you weren't supposed to open it. You're supposed to find an alternate route. And I remember something about door handles too. Maybe we had to touch the back of the door because if the door was hot, then the door handle was definitely hot. I can't 100% remember that. And then I do know that they would dress in their full firefighter outfit, or not outfit, but uniform, and show us what it looked like, you know, full mask, full respirator, all of that, so that we wouldn't be scared if we saw a firefighter in a house fire situation. And then I do remember them taking us to the truck. I don't remember ever like looking inside of it, maybe glancing inside of it, but I don't think we were allowed inside the truck. I can't 100% remember. But I do remember they like turned the sirens on, which was cool. And so, yeah, I think that's really important for firefighters to show students, especially young children, what they look like when they're breathing, you know, in the respirators and they have that mask on and their full body suits on, because it's important for little kids, especially, to not be afraid of them, because that could be the difference of, you know, survival or not in the situation of a house fire or something like that. So I think that's really important. And I think that, you know, firefighters, just as another side note, don't really make a lot of money. And I know a lot of firefighters who work second jobs because they can't afford to live on just the firefighting salary, which is not great, in my opinion. I understand that there's a lot of discontent around emergency services. And I think that firefighters in particular should get paid more, because their job is to literally risk their lives to save other people. And I think a lot of firefighters go undervalued. I think that they are put into some of the worst situations that you can be put into as a human, and expected to function at a high level in those kinds of situations. And we absolutely need people like that. But I also think that it is important to remember that they are human beings. And so they deserve some support, in my opinion. Anyway. Thinking about how we were taught about firefighters and fire safety in school got me thinking about stop, drop, and roll, and kind of where that came from. And apparently it began in the 1970s after there were many fires involving flammable clothing in the 1950s and 60s. The phrase became really well known after a 1974 PSA aired featuring Dick Van Dyke. And that got me thinking that maybe I should do a deep dive on like random PSAs that aired. Do you remember the one from, I think it was the late 80s maybe, and it was like, it's 9 o'clock, do you know where your kids are? Because like parents just didn't know where their kids were at night. And it's just, it's insane to me to think. We definitely have swung the other way as far as helicopter parents go, but there was a time when they had to have public service announcements asking parents to, or reminding parents to check and see where their kids were, because kids just were like, would be out and about doing whatever, you know. It's crazy. There's now better regulation around clothing and textiles and the materials that can be used for them, but back then, 500 to 750 people died annually due to clothing ignition, and in 2015 to 2019, the annual average of clothing ignition home fire deaths was 150. So we've definitely gone in the right direction as far as that goes, and honestly, I did not realize that it was because of flammable clothing that we were taught stop, drop, and roll. For some reason, I always assumed as a little kid that it was because you somehow tripped and fell into fire. Like whether that be a candle or I don't know, the fireplace, something to the fact that you like touched fire on accident and needed to stop, drop, and roll because of it. I never really connected the dots that it was because we were taught that because the potential of your clothing being on fire. So anyway. Coming back to the challenges with high-rise buildings, fire and smoke tend to spread vertically because of the buoyant nature of the heat produced in a fire, so it can be difficult to evacuate people from elevated floors. Additionally, fire department aerial apparatus, which is like ladder trucks, can only access a limited number of floors from the ground. So some modern safety measures that have been put in place, at least from an American perspective, are using non-combustible construction materials, fire alarm systems, including fire department communication systems. A lot of alarms will just directly notify the fire department as soon as they're tripped. Automatic fire sprinklers, smoke control systems, and having multiple fire and smoke protected exit stairs. That was one of the things from the documentary that I watched that was a really disturbing point of the documentary is the stairwell became so engulfed in smoke that people were passing out from smoke inhalation on the stairway. And so it was becoming blocked and difficult to navigate. And so a lot of people lost their lives trying to exit, but just not being able to make it out of the building because the stairwell was so engulfed in the smoke from the fire. So that was something that was really sad and got me thinking about how important it is that these exits are protected in modern construction, because I think that we're only going to see these buildings get more densely populated as we increase our population numbers. And so it's important to keep sort of this fire safety mindset when it comes to where you live and how things are constructed. So, in conclusion, I thought something like what to do in case of a fire was a universal policy, but watching the Grenfell documentary clearly shows that not to be the case. Fire safety is incredibly important, and everyone should know what to do in case of an emergency, regardless of where you are. Maybe consider looking up emergency protocols if you're traveling internationally as well. Knowing what to do in case of an emergency when you're not in your native country could be helpful. Emergency protocol doesn't need to be obsessed over, but it's something we should all know. Your brain isn't firing on all cylinders when you're in flight or fight mode, so already being prepared can save your life. Hopefully, you'll never be in a position to need to use your emergency protocol knowledge, but if you are, it's better safe than sorry. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll be seeing you next Friday.